This is the State of Things from the Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill, and I'm Frank Stacio. In the age of the internet, a lot of our public discourse happens online, in the comments section on Facebook. So what happens when the conversation takes a turn and the language becomes violent? Today we delve into a conversation about hate, harassment, and the right to report. It's a special program recorded in partnership with the UNC Hussmann School of Journalism and Media. Mary Rose Papandrea is a professor of constitutional law and associate dean of academic affairs at the UNC Law School. Mary Rose, welcome to the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel Glickhaus is a journalist and a partner manager for ProPublica's Documenting Hate Project. Rachel, welcome. Good to have you here. Mary Rose, we talk about hate speech. You hear about it all the time. And I wonder if there's a technical definition and a legal definition of hate speech.
There really isn't a legal definition. I think for most of us, you could say it's, I know it when I see it. But I think to sum it up, so we can have a working definition today, it's typically speech that attacks or denigrates a group based on race, national origin, gender, religion, sexual orientation, or other protected characteristics.
Now, we hear about laws or potential legislation that would address hate speech. Is there legislation, are there laws at the state or national level that that codify this and make it a crime?
There may be some out there, but they would be unconstitutional if they simply ban hate speech. There is no category of unprotected speech that's called hate speech. It would have to fall into, say, true threats or incitement or fighting words, defamation if done with intent. But hate speech by itself is not a category of speech that the Supreme Court has recognized as falling outside of the First Amendment.
But we can break the law. There are certain kinds of speech that would be seen as illegal. Now, what is not protected?
Well, there's a limited list of categories of unprotected speech. So one is incitement, so speech that advocates, is directed to imminent lawless action, that is unprotected. And the idea there is that there isn't time for speech to respond to prevent that violence. Another example would be fighting words that are uttered directly to a person that would cause a reasonable person to lash out and punch the speaker. True threats, speech that is made with the intent of putting a person within reasonable apprehension of bodily harm or violence. So there are a limited number of categories, and certainly some things that we think of as hate speech would fall within these categories. It's just not everything that some of us think of as hate speech would fall within these categories.
Has it been tested, and what are the rulings that govern, because I'm sure there have been attempts to somehow regulate what we call hate speech, and I wonder what the courts have said about them.
Right, the court has continued to hold the line that speech that is offensive, even if hateful, is protected. So one of the most recent decisions from the court is in a case called Snyder v. Phelps, which upheld the right of a hateful Westboro Baptist church to stand outside a public space. In this particular case, it was outside a funeral, and hold up signs that were terribly homophobic and attacking based on sexual orientation. And the court said that the First Amendment protects this kind of offensive speech. Another key case in this area is the RAV versus the City of St. Paul case from 1992, where the City of St. Paul tried to have a regulation that banned speech that attacked people on the basis of race, religion, national origin, and gender. And the court said that was a impermissible viewpoint-based speech restriction and struck it down as unconstitutional. So, any efforts that we've seen governments make to ban hate speech have fallen before the Supreme Court.
Rachel, let me ask you about hate crimes, because we do know that there is some behavior that's criminal. Talk about that and how that's distinct from perhaps hate speech.
Sure. So those are acts that are defined by the word itself, by committing some other underlying crime that is motivated by bias. So there's some other crime that has been committed, so robbery, assault, murder, but defining it as a hate crime comes from the idea that it was committed in whole or in part by bias against a person based on those protected categories she just mentioned, like religion, race, that sort of thing.
I wonder when some of these things may cross the line or blur the line. If you use a hate symbol, if you burn a cross on someone's lawn, it seems to me that you've broken some law somehow by being on their lawn in the first place and creating this damage. Yet the symbol, the symbolism is clear and hateful. How does the law?
In that RAV case I was mentioning, it involved a burning cross on a front lawn. Mm. And one of the things that was clear is that the city wanted to charge the perpetrators with arson, for example. That would have been perfectly fine. And as Rachel was mentioning, the Supreme Court in a case that followed soon after RAV has said that you can enhance the criminal punishment for crimes based on the motivation, if it's a hateful motivation. But the court reasoned that you're punishing the conduct, not speech. Now, for some, that may be a fuzzy line, but that is the line that the court drew.
Well, so let's take a look at this distinction when it comes to hate crime, Rachel. Again, a crime has been committed. There has probably been some form of assault or some kind of damage involved here, which could be prosecuted under ordinary laws. What is that level of distinction do for the aggrieved party, and why do we seek these in the first place?
So, the first thing you have to understand is that there are a lot of different kinds of hate crime laws, and they work differently. So there are federal hate crime laws. So if you're charged in federal court, it will fall under that law. But there are also many state laws, and they're very different. So some states don't cover certain protected categories. So, for example, in some states, if you commit a crime motivated by bias against an LGBTQ person, your state might not cover that category, and therefore you cannot be protected under the hate crime law. So what these laws are intended to do are to add additional time to the punishment. Some can only be used by prosecutors. They're very different, the laws in each state. But essentially, they are supposed to add some sort of additional punishment to the other crime that was committed, the underlying crime. And in theory, they are also supposed to be used as a symbolic measure to send a message to the overall community that was affected by the crime, precisely because these crimes tend not just to necessarily target the individual victim, but sometimes the greater community at large.
I would also think that this would affect what level of crime, and whether or not it's risen to the level of hate crime, affect the way crimes are investigated. And I wonder what you've learned in documenting hate about how investigations have changed in this environment.
So we have done a lot of investigation into how these crimes are treated and how police are prepared to investigate them. And we found just a huge patchwork across the country. So we found, for example, that not all police are trained in how to investigate hate crimes or what the hate crime law is in that state. Those rules about what police should be trained in varies by state, for example. Some don't get any training in the police academy. Some cities have a dedicated bias crime unit, many don't. How the individual police department will treat these types of crimes and the gravity to which they assign them can vary very widely. And then the last thing we found is that there's just a huge problem in reporting on behalf of law enforcement to the FBI. So the FBI is supposed to gather all this information about how many crimes are happening each year, but police departments don't have to send that information to them. It's not mandatory. And often the data that gets sent to them is incomplete or faulty. So we've done a lot of investigation into how police are investigating these crimes, but also how they're tracking them, because sometimes they're just not keeping track of them internally in a way so that the numbers they ultimately send are inaccurate.
You know, it might lead to, if you had the complete database, you might be able to make correlations between the level of hate speech and perhaps how particular communities are affected or how they're faring in a community, come up with better policy. But there is a flip side to this, and I suppose, Mary Rose, it gets to why we're so reluctant to control or prohibit hate speech, and that is that when we hear it, when we hear hate speech, we think of minorities that have already endured a great deal of suffering or grief within a society, now the victims of this. But if you outlaw it, you can imagine all kinds of parties claiming that so if I criticize the president, suddenly that's hate speech.
Oh, right, absolutely. So, you know, we do want to draw a distinction between the hate crime and the hate speech, where hate crime, as I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court has said it's absolutely fine to enhance punishments for crimes that aren't speech-based crimes. But, there's a real tension going on right now and a debate in our society about whether hate speech should be protected, you know, notwithstanding what the Supreme Court has said about it. And there's a growing concern that hate speech does cause real harm to communities, to marginalized communities in particular, that it's silent speech. So if you're thinking more holistically about our marketplace of ideas, that which is the hallmark of the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, better to let all speech thrive and compete, that you're actually silencing some important speakers in this marketplace who don't feel comfortable speaking because they are targeted because of their race or ethnicity or gender or so on.
Mary Rose Papandrea is a professor of constitutional law and associate dean of academic affairs at the UNC School of Law. Rachel Glickhaus is a journalist and partner manager for ProPublica's Documenting Hate Project. And we will pick up this conversation in just a moment on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things, recording a special broadcast at the Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about hate, harassment, and the right to report. This program is a partnership with the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media. We're joined by Mary Rose Papandrea, professor of constitutional law at the UNC School of Law, and Rachel Glickhaus, a journalist and a partner manager for ProPublica's Documenting Hate Project. Rachel, I know maybe I'll ask you to share the story from Pennsylvania about a struggle to get hate speech stick in a criminal offense.
Yeah, so as we were talking about before, this was a case that was a pretty clear-cut hate crime, right? So it was a family, a black family, that was living in a neighborhood where the next-door neighbor began to harass them. On a regular basis, which was a combination of vandalism, of breaking things on their property or leaving things on their dangerous or upsetting things on their property, and yelling things at them that were threatening and harmful slurs, that kind of thing. He also put up Confederate flags in the windows of his house, but only the ones that were facing that neighbor's home. They had children, and they would report him to police. And he was actually sentenced of two sort of minor offenses along the way. But this started in 2010, this harassment, and went on and on and on. And finally, what the family did was they decided to get cameras and start recording these interactions so that police had something more to work with to be able to use in court, essentially. So they were able to get this guy on camera, and eventually in 2018, he was sentenced to a hate crime, 2 to 4 years, on actual hate crime charges. But it took all of that time, the many, many police visits, a very long investigation, and ultimately they had to sort of take it upon themselves to record this in order to get to the point where there was an actual hate crime charge.
And this was a hate crime. Are there instances of hate speech crossing the line into criminal behavior or criminal charges?
So another case that actually resulted in an indictment last week was a case of a white supremacist based in Florida who was well known for harassing activists and journalists online. And he was harassing a would-be political candidate for city council in Charlottesville, Virginia. So this man wanted to run for office. This person allegedly threatened him on social media, and he decided not to run for office. So last week, an indictment came down, and he was arrested on charges of cyberstalking, threats, and essentially a civil rights charge for interfering with this man's right to run for office. And all of that happened online. Wow. According to the indictment.
So, Mary Rose, what does it take? Why is that a crime? Why are these sort of threats and things that I'm saying online taken to the seriously enough to be a crime? And would he have to have dropped out of the race in order for the law to take it seriously?
Well, I imagine that the lawyer for this white supremacist will challenge the charges and might invoke the First Amendment, particularly the restrictions on when threats are unprotected. And there actually is an open issue of whether the threats must be aimed at and intended to cause the person to feel intimidated. Now, that standard might be met. I'm not familiar. I haven't seen the posts. And I guess one message I want to make sure the audience gets today, one of the difficulties with these kinds of cases is that context is everything. And so from what you've said, and the very little I know about this case, it might very well be that this speech meets the standard for true threats and falls outside of the First Amendment. But it's hard to know in the abstract. And that's what makes these issues very tricky, because speech that is annoying and offensive and even somewhat threatening, it's open whether or perceived as threatening. The Supreme Court actually dodged the issue recently to decide whether that speaker must have the intent to put the person in harm, or whether it just must be the target must feel that they are threatened. And that can make an important difference,
right, particularly
if you're talking about artists and that sort of thing, like rap music and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, it's pretty difficult to get an intent. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're then taking the subjectivity, the feeling that I get from it, that's going to vary from case to case as well. Fascinating stuff. And the job of a journalist, of course, has shifted dramatically in the past few decades. And the work has moved online. And as that has happened, the harassment and vitriol aimed at reporters has followed. Alan Johnson is the executive editorial page editor with the Greensboro News and Record and the Winston-Salem Journal, and an adjunct lecturer at North Carolina A&T State University. He started at the News and Record more than 30 years ago, and of course he has seen some dramatic changes over the years. Alan, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
You're an editor at the News and Record, but you see, an important job, an important part of your job is getting out in the community. Do you have these discussions about some of the threats? I'm wondering, in your case, you've seen letters to the editor, right, for 30 years. Have things changed from where you sit?
Yes and no. One of the things about the technology is that we've always had people who were hateful. We've always had people who had very strong opinions. We've always had people who were angry. I think what's different about the technology now is that it allows people to do it so much more easily. And so I think people are emboldened and enabled, and I think they're even also, I think people get just kind of stupid when they get online. And they do things that just totally defy logic in terms of any sense of judgment. We had a case where an online commenter actually threatened to blow up the International Civil Rights Center and Museum in downtown Greensboro. He said this in a comment on a letter to the editor, and the State Bureau of Investigation tracked him down and scared the bejesus out of him. He was a college student. I won't mention the college, but it was a college in Greensboro. And I won't absolve UNC for now. But he was just mortified. He wasn't serious about it, but he didn't understand the gravity of what he was saying and how irresponsible it was for him to say something like that. So you get things like that occasionally, and it boggles the mind what people will do.
Well, and in this case, I think that student then made sort of a very large and very public apology. Was that the case? Or
well, he actually apologized to me. He wrote this very long apology and expressing one regret after another and saying he was sorry in so many different ways. But again, I think there's something about the internet that just makes people.
Well, perhaps the thing about it is that you don't have to engage another human body in the room, and that there's something about being together in a room that might change the way you talk to people.
I have a theory about that. We occasionally have meetings with online commenters.
But I don't even read the darn things, and you meet with them? All right.
Here's what we did. The first time we did it at a wine bar. That helps.
That helps.
But we didn't know these people, and a lot of them at the time were anonymous commenters. They had names that they used online. Now most people use their, as far as we can tell, they use their real names. But I was very surprised at how some of them were much more civil. Mm. In fact, all of them were more civil in person. And I have this theory that when people are disembodied, when they're sitting at a keyboard in front of a monitor, they feel much more liberated to say and do things that they just don't feel comfortable doing in person. One other thing, I'll say this real quickly, that we also do is some of our letter writers, I invite them, we have a community editorial board. That involves readers meeting with editors at the newspaper. We meet once a month, and I will invite readers, letter writers, particularly letter writers who don't like the paper. And so I'll invite them to come to the meetings, and I invite them to spice things up because I think, oh, this is going to be really good. We're going to have some great discussions. And generally, I guess I've been heartened and disappointed because they're so nice. when they come in. Not all of them are that mm-hmm. way. We were at a meeting last week, and the guy said, I was saying as a warm-up, can everybody say something about something you were wrong about? And this letter writer says, well, I was wrong. I thought Alan Johnson was a jerk. Oh. And I said, well, it's early. So that's a happy story. There are people who are just mean and hateful, and it doesn't change.
Well, there are many times when there are not happy endings. I want to bring Elisa Liz Munoz into the conversation now, Executive Director of the International Women's Media Foundation, which is an organization that works to empower and protect female journalists. Elisa, welcome. Let's talk about the experience as a female journalist in particular, as journalism has shifted online. What's happening there, and how have things changed, or have they?
I think that things have changed for female journalists as they're online more and more, and they are the targets often of this kind of hate that is being directed at them because of who they are. So it's really gender-based attacks online, and I think what's different is the volume of attacks, and the inability to get away from them, coupled with the need to be on social media to do their work. So there's no escape mechanism. When a journalist is on Twitter, on Facebook, and is receiving the kind of attacks that we have heard about in terms of the volume, the kind of speech, the threats against themselves, their families, their children, what we have found through our studies is that it causes similar impacts to PTSD, to being physically attacked. So these are really serious attacks, and they've often been called online harassment, and I don't call them harassment on purpose because they are attacks. They impact journalism tremendously. They impact the way that women journalists approach their stories, and they impact the stories that they're willing to take on, and they drive younger people mostly younger women, out of the news profession, which just exacerbates the gender inequity that already exists in the news media.
And if they don't leave the profession, I understand that they leave at least media organizations and end up going solo as a result of this.
Yes, well, freelancers leave for a lot of reasons, and they end up being even more vulnerable to physical attacks as well as online attacks. So the gig economy that most students in journalism will be a part of is one that leaves journalists very vulnerable, and so it's really necessary to figure out ways to support them.
Talk about this and help us understand why. I mean, because journalism is a tough business, and you're holding power accountable, and that means you're going to create a lot of enemies, and often a lot of powerful enemies. That's what we know was going to happen in this business, so we think we need to have a thick skin, and we need to ignore that kind of thing. Now, talk about why, in this environment, that's just easier said than done.
Yeah, that just doesn't work anymore. And the people that are attacking women journalists online aren't the people who they're holding to account. A lot of it is coming from the general public. A lot of it is coming from organized groups that target them directly and then can keep this volume going. So for weeks at a time, they lose control of their social media accounts and therefore can't work. Sometimes they have to relinquish their social media accounts because the impact of reading the stories and the threats that they're receiving is so harmful to them psychologically that they have other people read those. So journalists who are in media organizations are lucky enough to have some sort of editorial support, even though a lot of editors really don't understand or even to this day take seriously online attacks.
And talk about that. And again, this talks to speaks directly to representation, the fact that women are still not properly represented in the media and now face these threats and, as you say, are leaving. And so that means that the people in charge, you know, maybe from another generation and don't have that, quite have the experience or the understanding of how serious this is.
Yeah. The fact that there are fewer women in the news media, especially at the higher levels, has a real impact on how these issues are addressed. There's a journalist from the Sacramento Bee who was targeted online and was accused of having an affair with a congressman or public representative, and she tells a story of going back to her newsroom devastated that she's been maligned in this way, her journalism reputation has been tarnished, and her editor told her to brush it off. And thought that he was being really helpful, but she was left with a feeling of not being supported, and she ended up having to leave the paper because of other online attacks that she was receiving. So the kind of support that is given really needs to come in two ways. From a technological side, you really have to have digital security experts training journalists what they need to do to keep their private life off of line, to make sure that they're not being exposed accidentally by family members. It gets very complex. And also to being supported just editorially in the newsroom by their colleagues and by their editors.
Alan Johnson, is this something that you have encountered at the News and Record and had to start to come to terms with?
Yes, I did want to mention that I've had female colleagues, before I talk about my own experiences, who I think have gotten very vicious feedback for things they've written. I had a colleague who was a very popular news columnist, and the kind of stuff that she got was absolutely appalling.
Is it different than something you might have gotten? I mean, categorically, or
yes,
maybe I could ask Elisa if you're...
I would say so. I've gotten my share, but I would say that the kinds of things, the nature, some of the words used were just awful. That's the best way I can put it without quoting them.
Right. Well, Elisa, talk about that. Are they different in kind? Do women receive different sorts of attacks?
They do. Yeah, they do. I mean, gender-based attacks are gender-based. And so they're very misogynistic. They're references to their anatomy. And like I said, often directed at their family, directed at the kinds of things that people will do to them, would like to do to them, would like to see other people do to them, and then bring in another entire element, which is even potentially more disturbing, which is the deep fakes that are being produced, and just to explain for people who don't know what deepfakes might be, it's this capacity to put somebody's face on somebody else's body, and it's done a lot to journalists around the world, putting their face on pornographic images and then sharing them broadly around their town, around their country, around the world, which in some countries can be the equivalent of a death threat or a license to attack. And that is happening increasingly, and the ability to fight that is very, very difficult.
So, Alan Johnson, if these are different kinds of threats, are you taking different approaches at the newspapers you're working for?
Yes, I will say that during my career, I have had threats, and our bosses always made it clear to us, whenever you have one, take it very seriously. Don't dismiss it. There have been cases where we have contacted the Greensboro Police Department to come in just to be sure that something serious couldn't happen. I generally don't take them with a grain of salt. I try not to take them too seriously, but I try to take them seriously enough.
Elisa, what can be done, and what would you like to see happening in other newsrooms?
Well, I think it's important to educate yourself about the things that can be done proactively to prevent as much harm as possible. You're never going to be able to prevent all harm, but there are, it sounds silly to say, your social media settings can be set so that you are not disclosing more public information than you need to be disclosing. Honestly, a lot of people tell their families not to tag them in photographs, not to take photographs in front of their homes where you can see their address. It's kind of basic elements of self-preservation and security that if somebody walks you through it, you can be prepared to address it. And so what I think is needed is for more organizations to bring in that kind of help if they don't have it in-house, and to be very aware also of the personal and professional implications of the person who's receiving this kind of attack.
Elisa Liz Munoz is the executive director of the International Women's Media Foundation. I've also been talking with Alan Johnson, executive editorial page of the Greensboro News and Record and the Winston-Salem Journal, and Rachel Glickhouse, partner manager of Documenting Hate. She is a journalist with ProPublica, and our conversation will continue in just a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the Carolina Inn in Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio, today bringing you a special conversation about hate, harassment, and the right to report. It's recorded as a partnership with the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media. My guests are Alan Johnson, executive editorial page editor of the Greensboro News and Record and the Winston-Salem Journal, also an adjunct lecturer at North Carolina A&T. Elisa Liz Munoz is executive director of the International Women's Media Foundation, and she is with us as well. Elisa, talk about diversity in journalism and the number of women reporters these days.
Or lack of diversity in journalism is a better word for it. I hate to say it, but journalism is not a diverse industry, and it should be. It should really reflect our societies, and it doesn't. Most journalists are white, most journalists are men, particularly at the higher levels of media organizations, owners, publishers, editors. As you get into the reporter level, it evens out a little bit more, but still, last studies that were done, it's somewhere between around 30% of journalists are women. And that being coupled with almost 90% of journalism students and journalism graduate students being women. So one of the things that I often wonder is where is that cliff? Where do they fall off?
That's what I was going to ask you. What are the barriers? Are they not entering? They're entering, but not they're expressing an interest in journalism, but not making it into the industry. They are not staying in the industry.
They're not staying. Yeah. They're not staying in the industry. And it's like all glass ceilings. You know, if you don't see yourself, you don't see yourself, and you're not going to aspire to be that, and so you leave. There's a lot of inequity that has been documented around beats, around pay, equal pay issues. et cetera. I personally do not buy the line that it's a tough job. It's a tough job for families. It's a tough job for women because of they want to have children. I just don't buy it. I know too many journalists who want to be there and who can't be there.
Well, I wonder if the social media attacks and some of what we were talking about earlier, the fact that it is having such a profound effect, and now there are these platforms that can just be more powerful in their mm-hmm. reach and their impact is also creating another barrier. In other words, if they hadn't been
Absolutely.
There, maybe we'd see a steady rise, but we're losing that now.
Yeah, I think the fact that women are targeted, particularly online, does and has driven women out of the industry. I mean, I know several personally, and we've documented it through surveys and research, so that's well documented that women and those from other underrepresented communities also drop out of the news industry because it is all-consuming. I hope that I'm making clear how it overtakes your life when you open your computer and all you see is this kind of hate and attack constantly. And unfortunately, it's juxtaposed against a culture where it is this tough macho culture where they feel if I speak up, I'm not going to be sent on that beat. If I speak up, I'm going to be seen as a wilting flower and I cannot be trusted with these assignments. And so there's this hesitancy to really address them seriously, even within the journalist herself, for fear of backlash.
And you can't ignore social media because it's part of your job these days. It is integrated into news gathering, so it's part of what you do.
Yes.
You can't just make it go away. Ellen, what do you see as the spillover effects for recruiting women, for recruiting people of color in this industry?
Well, before we go to that, I don't want to let the industry off the hook. There's never been the kind of commitment that I felt there should be. I won't blame that on hate speech. I blame that on an industry that hadn't done what it should do. Another thing I've gone through this over my career and talking about diversifying the staff and hearing very flimsy excuses for why staffs aren't more diverse. Well, we can't find one, or we can't find one who's qualified enough, or we had one time and it didn't work out. I just have never bought that. But what has made a bad situation worse? Before I say that, I've seen too many people of color who are really good and who have done wonderful work in this profession to know that that's not true. But the other thing that's happened with the economics is we've downsized, we don't hire as much, staffs are smaller, and when we started downsizing, a lot of journalists of color were casualties. And so a bad situation didn't become worse, it became terrible. So we have all of that operating, and so I just can't blame hate speech for that. I think that complicates it, but there just hasn't been all along the effort that it should have been.
Elise, I know you're running a campaign called Check Your Bylines. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, our Check Your Bylines campaign is basically a challenge to all of us to take note of who we're reading, what news we're consuming, who's in your news feed. I think at the end of the day, most of us will be pretty surprised by who is influencing our view of the world, and it's mostly older white men. And so it's a challenge to spend some time to check those bylines and to try to diversify them. And I just want to be clear, I think that everybody can be a great journalist, and white men are great journalists. I just think that we should have a diversity in the field that is representative of our communities. And just check your bylines. I encourage you to do so.
Well, Ellen has made a case for some of the other barriers, but certainly the rise of hate speech and the kind of attacks that journalists are facing is one of the barriers. And then the question, of course, becomes, what do we do about it? I want to bring into the conversation now Wendy Scott, who is an associate dean for academic success and a professor of law at Elon University, and bring back Mary Rose Papandrea of UNC Law to talk about where we can go legally. Let's welcome to the program. And Wendy, a lot of this hate speech is taking place on privately owned, publicly traded corporations and their platforms, and they are, you know, entities unto themselves. How can we, or how do we, regulate what happens on those platforms?
Well, I think the first point to make is that the First Amendment and the rest of the Bill of Rights only limits the government's action. It doesn't limit private action. And so to the extent that the government cannot limit our speech through regulation, the content of our speech, they can limit the way it's delivered or the time, place, and manner. The content can't be regulated by the government. That same limitation does not exist on private companies. And so to the extent that private companies like Facebook or any of the other social media platforms have the ability to regulate speech, and we've seen that happening slowly, what may be their reluctance is the impact it would have on their profits. And so it's not a question of being limited by the law or the Constitution in being able to regulate that content. I think there are other factors like profit and business models and decisions that have prevented more regulation of content, although we're beginning to see it come into play.
We've talked about the damaging effects that social media can have and some of these messages and hate speech, and then the fact that these social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, aren't regulated, but they could regulate themselves. Do we want them regulating themselves? What if they came up with the rules for who does and who does not get on? I mean, I'd love it if what targets, disenfranchised groups is censored, but I'm guessing that might not be how it turns out.
Mm-hmm. Well, so far it has been self-regulated. I think Twitter is a good example of a social media company deciding to limit access of certain people. YouTube, with Alex Jones, I believe it is. And so maybe it's the outrageous test, right? If it becomes so outrageous that there's a great deal of public outcry, then you will see intervention on the part of those companies themselves. And it's not that they're totally unregulated. I mean, it's sort of a uncharted waters, because we know that the government regulates the media, right? And we know that they regulate licensing and things like that. But this is a different animal, and I think the government is still trying to figure out what is their role in the regulation, not just of speech, but of the platform itself. So I do think that public pressure and the fact that as a culture we believe in free speech, and as a culture we believe that speech shouldn't be limited, even though there is no constitutional basis for limiting that speech. Culturally, there's a reluctance to limit speech. And I think that has helped the social media folks explain why they're hesitant to regulate, but culture also puts pressure on them to regulate when things get very outrageous.
Well, Mary Rose, what about this? I mean, we talked about, as Wendy said, this is kind of a different animal. How different an animal is this than other media, radio, television, newspapers, that have, fallen under some regulation and self-regulation as part of our media landscape?
Well, there's one law we should talk about, which is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And this was passed by Congress in 1996. So the law provides immunity for the platforms, for the speech by third parties, so the users. And the reason that was passed was that before that time, courts were starting to hold the platforms liable if they took off speech that was indecent, they took offensive speech off. And so the regulation was meant, or the law was meant, to encourage the censorship. So if they wanted to engage in the censorship, this law would let them. Otherwise, they would turn into publishers and be held liable, fully liable for that.
I see.
Speech.
So are you saying that the individual who may have posted this thing wouldn't be held, but if you're the outlet, we're going to get...
Right. The law does not protect the individual poster. Yeah. It only protects the platform from liability.
I'm going to ask kind of a big question here, and I'll stick with you, Mary Rose, and then I'll ask you, Wendy, the same question, which is to take one giant step back. We know you've explained very well what the law does and what it does not protect. But remember, this whole free speech argument begins a couple of centuries ago when we assumed that human beings were rational. And this was the rise of the modern age, where reason was dominant and the whole world was going to be transformed by this reason. And then there was the nuclear bomb, and we said, oh, wait, it could go awry. And so there are ways in which reason doesn't work anymore. And it's very clear. If we actually had an election that was tainted by foreign powers tricking people into believing things that aren't true, and it's quite evident from the research that something like that happened, where an entire election, do we have to sort of rethink the premise of free speech and ask ourselves just how rational we are when it comes to making decisions? There's plenty of psychological research, by the way, that points to the fact that we're highly irrational.
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned earlier this marketplace of ideas. It is a foundational principle in the court's First Amendment jurisprudence, but there have been many people who criticize that the marketplace doesn't really work. And one thing they point to is the psychological research that it's very hard to dislodge false facts once people hear them, that people have bounded rationality, that they tend to live in a cocoon and only expose themselves to speech that they agree with. So there are a lot of critics that this marketplace model that the court's jurisprudence is founded upon no longer holds true. Or maybe it never did, to be honest, but that's the, particularly nowadays, there's that concern.
Right. What about that, Wendy? Do you think that we may come up with a new rationale and a new foundation for generating new law to govern this arena?
Well, as much as the marketplace of ideas or the open forum concept has its limitations, I do think it is what makes our democracy unique. And so that, I think, gives me pause to say we need to jump in and regulate and say who can't say what. On the other hand, it takes us back to hate speech and the fact that there are words that cross the line, even though the court has only carved out a few exceptions. Those exceptions can give us guidance in how we regulate speech online. So if you were, for instance, to think about Alex Jones and the things that he has said, could we apply the First Amendment test? Is he falsely shouting fire? Is he inciting imminent lawlessness? Maybe that standard could be applied, even though we're not necessarily saying it's the First Amendment, but it's those exceptions to free speech that could be a guide to self-regulation, private regulation. The closest we're getting to any type of state or federal intervention are the investigations that have been started by several attorneys general, not into the speech online, but into whether they're violating antitrust laws. Some people might say it's a fishing expedition to see if you can then turn that into some regulation of their content, but for now, it's sort of on the outskirts, on the periphery. But I do think we can draw lessons from First Amendment jurisprudence as to how we measure what speech belongs in the marketplace and what speech doesn't.
Well, I want to thank all of our guests, Wendy Scott, an Associate Dean for Academic Success and a professor at Elon University. Elisa Liz-Munoz is Executive Director of International Women's Media Foundation. Alan Johnson, the Executive Editorial Page Editor of the Greensboro News and Record, also the Winston-Salem Journal and an Adjunct Lecturer at North Carolina A&T. Rachel Glickhouse is a journalist and the Partner Manager for ProPublica's Documenting Hate Project. And Mary Rose Papandrea, a Professor of Constitutional Law and Associate Dean of Academic Affairs at the UNC School of Law. Thank all of you for being on our program today. And thank you as well. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hull of Mormon. Josie Taras is with us today. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski also engineered. Special thanks to the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media and their staff who assisted us in putting together this show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.